This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Michael Phelps can relax. Track and field athletes can't for another week, and neither can Helene Elliott, now covering the Athens Games for the Los Angeles Times. She joins me now on the line from Athens. Hi, Helene.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. Swimming wraps up today with the women's 50-meter freestyle and the men's 4x100 medley relay, among other races. When the Athens Games are over, will this Olympiad be remembered as an especially notable one for swimming?
Michael Phelps is the reason to remember these Olympics, and not only for what he did, but I think for the gesture he made in giving up his spot in that final medley relay to Ian Crocker. I mean, he didn't have to do that. He had earned that spot. He would have moved closer to all kinds of records for winning medals. But I think that shows a lot about the guy's character, and it's really nice to see when we're used to bad news and about drug scandals and cheating and smarmy judging and things like that. It's nice to see somebody act with some kind of integrity.
Track and field will garner much of the attention in the wake of swimming's conclusion. American sprinters fared well on Friday. To which track athletes, American or otherwise, should we be paying special attention?
Justin Gatlin will be fun to watch. Sean Crawford, they both did well in the U.S. Olympic trials last month. But I'm really intrigued by this Jamaican kid named Asafa Powell. He's very young, but he's very confident. He never really seriously ran track until about 3 years ago, he said. He used to play soccer, and so a teacher of his in high school saw him running on the soccer field and said, hey, wait a minute, you should be running track. And here he is just a few years later at the Olympics, and he's going to be around, I think, on the international scene for quite a while.
Helene, from the perspective of TV viewers, it would seem that many Olympic venues are nearly empty for some of the events and only about half full for gymnastics, even some of the most popular events, at least in the past. Is the Greek Olympic Committee's assertion that they've sold 57% of the available tickets an accurate one?
I think part of the problem is that the tickets were priced so ridiculously beyond the reach of most people that that's why you're seeing all these empty seats. I suspect that if they had priced them more reasonably, you would have seen a lot more seats full. A colleague of mine wanted his wife and daughter to go to the gymnastics the other night and was told that the only tickets available were $200 each. And he loves his wife and daughter, but maybe not quite that much. We're cheap in this business, but that's another story. But, you know, the average working person is not going to be able to plunk down, you know, $400, $600 to go to see a gymnastics event. And, you know, one other factor, too, that a lot of people maybe don't realize back in the States is that August is a very, very traditionally big vacation month in Europe. I suspect that a lot of people here in Greece were worrying about whether roads would be crowded and just decided to get out of town and maybe now are coming back once they see that things are a little bit better than we were all led to anticipate.
After the U.S. women's basketball team defeated the Czech Republic on Monday, Lisa Leslie said that the U.S. men's team should attend the women's games so they could learn about international basketball. This is the sort of criticism that would have been unimaginable a few years ago.
Well, she was laughing when she said it, and I think she said it for the impact of it. And, you know, Amika Okafors and I think it was Richard Jefferson were at the U.S. women's game that day, which I thought was kind of neat. But all these European countries have picked up on basketball over the last 10, 15, 20 years, and the competition is so much better than the U.S. women are facing that there really is no comparison.
Helene, four of the U.S. softball team's seven games have ended because of the mercy rule. They've outscored opponents 41-0 over the course of their schedule so far. All this prompts the burning question, does the U.S. bring home gold in softball?
Yeah, the U.S. women will win the gold medal in softball. And, you know, it's not quite it's a nice story, and it'll probably be the last Olympics for Lisa Fernandez and Lori Harrigan and some of the stalwarts on that team. And but it just points up that, you know, the rest of the world isn't anywhere near that kind of level. And I know that softball's existence on the Olympic program has kind of been threatened once or twice, and you kind of have to wonder if maybe it really doesn't belong there.
The Olympics present an opportunity to watch sports that many don't have the opportunity to see on other occasions. Which of the more obscure sports have you had an opportunity to observe while you've been there in Athens?
Well, it's funny. I went out to the women's saber fencing the other night and just had a blast. It was terrific. It's theater. It's a spectacle. And you know, the athletes there were so grateful to see all the reporters. It was really refreshing. And there's some great stories to be told in sports like sailing and rowing and fencing and team handball. I mean, these are athletes who are not making a lot of money. Most of them are working other jobs so they can train and compete. And it's just great to talk to some of these folks and hear the inspirational stories and some of the things that they go through.
You're a veteran Olympic reporter, but our listeners, of course, know you primarily as our NHL expert. So here's a rare chance for you to parlay your vast knowledge and tell us something about the field hockey competition currently ongoing.
They wear skirts. No, that's just the women. No, honestly, I have not been out to field hockey, although I must say that when we were doing our Olympic previews and they said, well, we have to preview the hockey. I said, no, we have to call it field hockey. Oh. Let's just be clear about that.
Well, they tell me that although there are corners in which one can muck it up, there are no boards there.
No. So what's the fun? Where's the fun?
Helene of Troy, actually Elliot of Athens, is the ace who launches thousands of words every day for the LA Times. She's also only a Games Pallas Athena of the pentathlon. Helene, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
The baseball competition at the Olympics suggests that the game isn't much of a draw, that the Greek, or more accurately, Greek-American team is a terrific feel-good story, if not an especially competitive side, and that Greek fans are mystified by our national pastime, as Christoforos Kostikas, 25, confessed at a game this week.
It's something different here in Greece. Strange for us. We don't know the rules. We are from Greece. We think that sports like that, they don't need to be in Olympic Games.
That's a view that may eventually prevail. In May, the International Olympic Committee voted to postpone consideration of eliminating baseball from the Games, but until that decision, there had been worry that the 2008 Games in Beijing would transpire without peanuts and Cracker Jack. Among the committee's concerns are that baseball is not played in a sufficient number of countries, that Major League Baseball has not been willing to release the game's best players to compete for their national teams, and that building venues for baseball in countries with no baseball tradition is expensive and silly. Nor is baseball the only game that has some members of the IOC sharpening their knives. On Tuesday afternoon, players from the Akron Racers and the New England Riptide were getting loose prior to their pro fast-pitch softball league doubleheader at Martin Field in Lowell, Massachusetts. For some of them, two games on the same hot day would be a challenge since they've been watching some of their friends play on the Olympic team.
Me and some of the other girls, we set our alarms and wake up at 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning and watch them. But last night they played at 2 in the morning. We didn't get to watch that. But we've been trying to catch every game that we can.
That's Aya McMichael of Nacogdoches, Texas. She plays center field for Akron. According to Racers manager Judy Martino and Ralph Raymond, who led the U.S. team to gold medals in Atlanta and Sydney and now manages the Riptide, McMichael is one of just two players on the field with a great shot at making the U.S. Olympic team, which will play at the 2008 Games in Beijing. The other is New England pitcher Jocelyn Forrest. Beyond 2008, the opportunity may disappear. Softball may be cut, in part because the gap between the U.S. team and everybody else is so pronounced. I asked Jocelyn Forrest if that inclined her to root against the U.S. team.
You know, no. Of course, I want the USA to bring home the gold. Maybe if the games are just a little tougher, you know, and we still walk away with the win, maybe that could change things.
In Athens, the undefeated U.S. team has outscored the opposition 41-0 over 7 games. U.S. pitching has allowed only 11 hits. If a monopoly on gold medals, among other factors, leads the International Olympic Committee to strike softball from its roster, Jocelyn Forrest thinks the game in the U.S. will be diminished.
I'd like to say it would be the same, but unfortunately, I don't think it would. That's really the ultimate goal for a lot of people. Not everybody, but for a lot of people it is, and it's just pretty much the most prestigious thing you can do in softball.
Though softball may lose some of its best athletes to other sports if it's no longer in the Olympics, nobody is arguing that the sport would disappear. That is a possibility for one of the other sports the IOC may cut, the modern pentathlon, the combination of horseback riding, swimming, shooting, running, and fencing that became an Olympic sport in 1912. Anita Allen, who will represent the U.S. in the modern pentathlon on Friday, worries falling out of the Olympics would kill her sport.
Unfortunately, I think it would be the final chapter in the book because it is an expensive endeavor. And without the carrot hanging in front of your face of the Olympics, I don't think that the sport would survive. I don't think people would invest their money. I just don't think it would happen.
Allen is concerned that though her sport was created for the modern Olympics by none other than founder Baron Pierre de Coubertin himself, the current members of the IOC won't value the excitement of the modern pentathlon over more mundane considerations.
It's a great sport, and it's so challenging. And you really truly have to be a dedicated athlete. Why else would you train 12 hours a day and compete all day long in an event that frustrates the hell out of you? But that's a hard thing to sell sometimes. Even though you may have all the passion in the world, you don't bring in the dollars, so it's a hard fight.
In the matters of modern pentathlon, softball, and baseball, as well as other threatened sports such as race walking, canoe, kayak, slalom, and badminton mixed doubles, among others, the members of the IOC are not likely to act precipitously, though the committee has added lots of sports to the modern games, baseball in 1992, for example, and softball in 1996. It has not cut a sport from the game since polo got the axe in 1936. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Okay, breathe deeply, relax.
Some Olympians meditate to relax, others listen to music. You can tell by the earphones. But so far as we know, South African archer Kristen Jean Lewis, a Cape Town chemical engineer, is the only competitor who stays calm, courtesy of Mickey, Donald, and Goofy. My coach has been keeping me relaxed by telling me stories from Disney cartoons, Lewis said on Monday. The efficacy of the tactic was clear on Tuesday when Lewis shot a 157 out of a possible 180 during the women's individual archery competition.
Ha ha! Oh, gosh.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. The Iraqi soccer team plays on. But first, joining me now on the line is Dan Wetzel, who is covering Olympic basketball, among other things, for Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The uproar following the U.S. team's 19-point loss to Puerto Rico last Saturday has subsided after wins over Greece and Australia this week. Is it too optimistic to say the U.S. team has found itself?
Well, this remains a flawed basketball team because they lack great shooters. But the effort level, the commitment to defense and rebounding and playing together is much improved. There's no question that the team has come together on that element. There's very little finger-pointing or complaining about playing time or anything like that. So that's optimistic for the United States that at least this group, while not perfect, is going to play as hard as they can.
You mentioned that one of the obvious problems was there weren't enough good shooters on this team, maybe no pure shooters. In 2002, a squad of NBA All-Stars finished sixth in the World Championships in basketball, but USA Basketball did not subsequently change the method by which they assemble teams for international play. Did they think the result in 2002 was a fluke?
Well, I don't know. It's no question this team is not very well assembled, and who chose the team remains a mystery at this point because there's a 10-person selection committee that Larry Brown is blaming, and if you talk to people on the selection committee, they'll tell you Larry Brown had the most say in who went to the team. Nobody seems to want to claim ownership to it, but it's unquestioned that there are a predominance of great athletes on the wing. It's long on marketing potential, but it's not a great veteran team. The average age is 23.6 years, which is awful young for this competition. It makes the U.S. one of the youngest teams here.
Some folks have said that the U.S. team in Athens is representative of today's NBA team or NBA stars, wonderfully talented but lacking in fundamentals and unwilling or unable to play within a team concept. Is that an accurate observation?
Yeah, I think the guys they selected do fall into that in some ways. Most of these guys are used to being the best player on their team and always have been, spent their entire life as the star. They're not used to passing the ball when you're always the one expected to shoot it. Also, the NBA game and the college game and the high school game in the United States, athletic ability is celebrated. Dunks are celebrated. Flashy play is celebrated a lot more than, you know, moving without the ball or setting a great pick or doing some of those winning things. I think that's where some of this comes from. I do think these guys play very hard, and I think they can really defend when they want to, and they've shown the ability to do it. But there's no question that when you watch the other teams play, it's much more of a cohesive unit. There's a lot better passing, a lot better shot selection and things like that out of the other international teams, particularly the European team.
Dan, regarding what would be best for American basketball in the long run when the team plays in international competition, would it be better if the U.S. failed to medal in these Olympics in the sense that it would shake things up?
Well, it's certainly possible that a total wipeout would shock the system so much that there would be a rebuilding of it. I do think that nobody wants to be a part of a losing team, that maybe those changes will be made. I think there really needs to be a commitment to joining the team for more than 1 year and getting a little bit more cohesive in your style of play, playing together more. And I think we can solve this problem without losing the gold, and I would like to think that, you know, the United States would always be better off winning these competitions if you're going to compete in them. But there's certainly a school of thought, and there's a lot of people in the country that are, quite frankly, rooting against the United States in this competition because they don't like the players or they don't like the style of play or they do want to see a change.
Let's approach this whole question from a different angle. To what extent have the difficulties of the U.S. team been caused by the improvement of teams like Argentina, Spain, Lithuania, and Puerto Rico as well?
That's the biggest thing, is they've closed the gap. 12 years ago, when the original Dream Team was put together, there was absolutely no competition out there. And even for a long stretch, even deficient superstar NBA players could dominate. I still think if we sent our absolute A-grade NBA players, Shaquille O'Neal, Tracy McGrady, we would still be able to win with that. But once you get to that second tier, it's quite even. We've done such a good job exporting our game of basketball that the rest of the world has caught up and plays it quite well.
Team USA plays a very strong Lithuanian team a little later on today. Even if the U.S. team loses that game, it will most likely make the medal round. Is a gold medal still within reach?
I think it's in reach because they have the best athletes. They're going to have to win a little bit ugly, though, which is a little unusual for the U.S. It's not just going to be, well, once we get it together, we're just going to blow teams out. Those days are done. The days of the U.S. just walking into tournaments and being the favorite and overwhelming anyone are over, and they're never coming back. But they can do it. I wouldn't say they're the favorite to win the gold medal right now, but they're certainly one of the two or three favorites to win the gold medal.
Dan Wetzel covers the Olympics for Yahoo Sports. He joined me on the line from Athens. Dan, thank you again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Today in Athens, Dallas assistant coach Don Nelson will lead his Lithuanian squad against the struggling U.S. men's basketball team. His Mavericks colleague, Team China head coach Del Harris, will try to knock off Team USA tomorrow. These are two high-profile examples of American basketball coaches working abroad, but that phenomenon is not particularly new. Greg Eklund reports.
Gary LeMoyne, now 52, grew up in Muskogee, Oklahoma, not far from the oil pumps. Oil, however, was not to become LeMoyne's calling. Instead, it was basketball.
It's a love affair that goes way back. I love the pace of the game and the athleticism of it.
LeMoyne's first head coaching job would be in the oil-rich Middle East. In 1987, he took over the Manama Sports Club, a pro team in Bahrain. But armed conflict in the region almost forced him to stay in the States.
And that's when Iran was fighting Iraq in the 8-year war. I was afraid to go, but I was overlooked for a high school head job here in the States, and so I just decided to take the chance to just go. It just opened up a new world for me, and 1 year led to another, and so here I am, you know, 20 years later, I'm still, I have contacts in the Persian Gulf.
LeMoyne discovered that his players were able to put aside religious and political differences and learn about basketball.
A lot of times, because you were American, you got instant respect because of your knowledge and where you came from and everything. So basically, I was always treated well overseas, but I always tried to make the place better than the way I found it. That was my rule.
In 1993, LeMoyne became the head coach of the Mongolian national team that competed in the first East Asian Championships in Shanghai, China. He left within a year for a job as a head coach of a professional team in Kuwait. When the U.S. invaded Iraq in March 2003, LeMoyne was coaching the Syrian national team. He returned to the States a few days later as a safety precaution and has been in Urbana, Illinois ever since. This summer, LeMoyne has helped out at Coach Bruce Weber's camp at the University of Illinois. He has also worked with high school players at the National Guard Fieldhouse near his home in Urbana.
Go ahead and back up just a little bit, Josh. As you get warmed up, gradually move back.
John Potter, now a basketball agent based in Tulsa, played for LeMoyne in 1986 and 87 when LeMoyne was an assistant high school coach in Durant, Oklahoma. Potter moved on to play college ball for Oklahoma State in the early 90s. LeMoyne earned Potter's respect, and they've stayed close ever since.
He has a great knowledge regarding basketball, and probably all of it is self-taught. Not very many dedicate themselves to the game and to understand the game and to better themselves in the game like he has.
LeMoyne's knowledge of the international game provides insight into the basketball players who are competing in Athens, especially the Asians and Europeans.
They develop an all-round skill. They spend a lot more time on shooting probably than we do in their practices. And if you'd notice, that's the difference between the Europeans and us now. So I think that we can learn from that. I think that you need to have a low post player and you can teach both. And even in Asia, you know, Yao Ming comes to mind. You know, he's learning a post-up game now. He's getting stronger. But you see, he can shoot the three. He can face up.
4 years ago in Sydney, Yao Ming averaged 10 points a game for his Chinese national team. LeMoyne first saw Yao Ming play in 1997 while scouting for a pro team in Qatar, when Yao was 18, playing on the Chinese national team. He also saw another member of the Chinese frontline referred to as the Great Walking Wall. 6'11", Mink Batir. Both are currently representing China. Though LeMoyne feels the U.S. is the best defensive team, he says the world is catching up, including the host team.
Greece has very good basketball. It's very big in Greece. So Italy is good. Spain has good basketball. China by far is the best country in Asia. So eventually, I think they will catch up to Europe.
Even as LeMoyne cites the recent progress of European and Asian basketball, he points out that there were clear signs more than 10 years ago that the game would soon become an international phenomenon.
I was up near Siberia in the upper part of Mongolia. This was back in 93, and I saw a kid wearing the Chicago Bulls and then the 92 Dream Team, the original Dream Team. You saw kids wearing, you know, T-shirts like that. So that's one of the most remote places I've ever been in the world. So you know that it's reached the four corners of the world when you see something like that.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Urbana, Illinois.
Each Olympiad features at least one unexpected storyline. Those pivotal 3 seconds in the gold medal basketball game in 1972, the miracle on ice in 1980, Rulon Gardner's miracle on the mat in Sydney. The unexpected success of the Iraqi soccer team in Athens hasn't quite measured up to those shockers yet, but the Iraqi team finished the preliminaries at the top of their bracket and will face Australia in the quarterfinals later today. Tom Ferry of ESPN.com has been following Olympic sports in Iraq for more than 2 years. He joins me now on the line. Tom, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, good to be here.
Much has been said, of course, about the conditions the Iraqi Olympic team and in particular the soccer players there faced under the previous Iraqi regime, but maybe you can refresh our memory a little bit.
Well, this is one of the worst chapters in, I think, the history of sports. Saddam Hussein's son, Uday, taking control of the Olympic Committee and the Soccer Federation in 1984, and over time coming to believe that the best way to motivate players was to torture and punish and throw in jail those who made a bad pass or missed a goal or made some type of error or just simply aggravated him. He was quite arbitrary. He wasn't a good observer of soccer talent or what would go wrong in a game. And the players certainly lived in fear for many years. They just generally didn't play very creatively. It's kind of hard to take that risk-taking pass or shot when you think it might cost you when you get back home to Baghdad. So they didn't do very well for many years, and they fell down to probably, you know, the 80th best team in the world or so.
Are any of the same athletes from those dark days playing on the team that's in Athens now?
Yes. You got to remember, the current team that you're seeing in the Olympics right now has been playing together as a group for the better part of, you know, 4, 5, 6 years. In the Olympics, most of the players have to be under the age of 23, and these elite youth national youth teams begin, you know, in the mid-teens or so. So a lot of these guys have been together as a nucleus for years, and Uday did pay attention to what happened with the youth teams as well, and here and there players would be thrown in jail and would be punished.
After the team's only loss to Morocco on Thursday, a number of the Iraqi players spoke to the media, and they asked President Bush to stop using images of the team in his campaign ads. Were you surprised to hear that request?
No, not at all. You know, I did a follow-up report in which I caught up with the current team members. We got under this whole issue. These guys are used as political pawns. The coalition has put a lot of energy and effort into creating a real PR moment here in the Olympics. They knew that if they could get the team into the Olympics, the storyline would be pretty simple. Players were tortured. They didn't play well. Uday and Saddam are gone. They're playing better. Clearly, Iraq is better off. And, of course, we helped move them forward. And there's some truth to that, certainly. But the players, what they'll tell you is that's only half the story. They're fighting not just their past, but their present. And their present consists of, you know, civil strife and the threat of violence. And they, till a couple months ago, had no fields to work out on because we had bombed their stadiums. We gave $10 million, the coalition gave $10 million to the Iraqi Olympic Committee. But the money isn't filtering down to the players. Not much of it is. These guys have to buy their own shoes, find their own transportation to practice. Sometimes they can't even get there because it's so dangerous or the electrical outages are so bad that traffic is at a gridlock. You know, crime is terrible. They fear for their lives when they cross town. They're not like U.S. athletes, you know, well-paid U.S. athletes where they can sort of live this separate existence from the rest of us. I mean, they live in the same neighborhoods as these people, and so they represent the sentiment of the people, which right now is very anti-Bush and anti-U.S.
When the team qualified for the Olympic Games, Iraqis celebrated in the streets, and when Iraq scored its first goal against Portugal, it took 3 minutes to clear the field of excited fans. Now that Iraq is in the quarterfinals for the first time since 1980, what do you expect today's game to be like in terms of response?
Depends on how many Iraqis they let into the stadium. But there will be delirium. It is one big opportunity to celebrate something, anything positive that's happening in Iraq right now. And Iraqis are very eager to do that.
How do you like the Iraqi team's chances on the field? Can this team go all the way?
I don't know if they can go all the way. I mean, it's kind of shocking they've gotten this far anyway. They've got a pretty good coach. They haven't had as much international experience as some other teams have. They don't have anybody playing in Europe, so they don't have guys playing at high-level pro leagues. However, they have played as a group together for many years, and they are really driven to give their people something to rally around. There's a real sense of patriotism there. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they win today. I mean, Australia is certainly not a world power. Getting through the semis, whoever they play there, I think would be much, much more unlikely, and actually winning the whole darn thing, boy, that would be incredible, but I would be very surprised if that happens.
Shakir Jubari, an Iraqi businessman who's distributed nearly 2,000 tickets to Iraqis in Athens, has said, quote, "These matches bring all Iraqi people together, Sunni, Shiite, Kurd, Christian. Football has succeeded in doing what the entire Iraqi government and U.S. occupation authority failed to do." If that's true, what kind of effect could meddling at these games have on the country at large?
You know, sports is always very interesting. It seems to bond people, and then they leave the stadium or the moment fades, and we're back to the same old stuff. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The fact that Iraq beats Australia or beats Costa Rica in a soccer game, I mean, it doesn't solve, you know, the problem of, gee, is electricity working in Iraq, and boy, why aren't murders being prosecuted in Iraq? I mean, let's not take this too far. However, I think that it will give them a sense of pride. It will give them a sense of the potential for greatness. This team has elements from all over a unified Iraq.
Tom Ferry is a senior writer for ESPN.com. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Mark Spitz, tanned, rested, and still the gold medal champ. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I'm sorry, stuck in my head.
On Thursday, gymnast cum superstar Carly Patterson won Olympic gold in the women's all-round. Paul Hamm won gold in the men's competition on Wednesday. Do these victories signal the beginning of an American gymnastics dynasty?
I have no idea.
Me neither.
Apparently, the old powers are falling apart a little bit. Carly Patterson, somebody was making this point earlier today. Has her coach put her down yet? Because he sort of carried her all around. I think he's probably took her up to the Acropolis. No, these were two very clutch performances, especially Paul Hamm.
Absolutely.
Who fell smack on, you know, what we veteran Olympics watchers call his keister.
And almost
into the judges' table and managed to come back and win. They grow him tough in Waukesha, what can I tell you?
I love the idea that all the commentators were wrong. Because when
they
fell on his case, he's finished, it's over.
Well, what's my golden Olympic moment? Any moment where Al Troutwig shuts his pile?
It has been a historic week of parries and ripostes for the U.S. fencing team.
There we are.
Will the medals won by Mariel Zagunas and Sada Jacobson raise the sports profile here in the U.S.?
I think it will raise the sports profile for women, particularly in Saber. Absolutely. There are a couple of other really terrific results. Soren Thompson, the men's epee, has made the top eight, which is a very good result. And the men's Saber team just had the day from hell on Thursday, losing in the semifinals to France 45-44 in a bizarre match in which we got cheated, I say.
And then blowing
a lead to the Russians in the final match of the bout because they ran into Stanislav Poznikov, who is the best Saber fencer who ever lived.
All right, Charlie, aside from the Al Troutwig reference, have you a favorite Olympic moment that you can share at the midpoint of the extravaganza?
It's very hard to know that because until track and field starts, you generally don't get your favorite Olympic moment. But I'll tell you what, my favorite Olympic person so far has been the way that Allen Iverson, of all people, accepted the defeat to Puerto Rico, where he came out in the press conference and said, I hope people watch the way we got our butts kicked because that's the way people are supposed to play.
The U.S. men's basketball team is 2-1. They face a very good Lithuanian team a little later on today. Whether or not the team prevails, LeBron James now has his very own Powerade flavor. I'm sure he's delighted by that.
That would be Flava,
yeah,
by the
Flava,
way, not
sorry.
Flava, as the kids say.
Sorry.
See, I'm down with that.
Any chance that they will overnight great numbers of cases of this stuff to the U.S. team?
I wouldn't be at all surprised, but I will tell you one thing. LeBron James is the difference in this tournament. He's the one player that the United States has that nobody else in the world has, and Larry Brown is slowly tumbling to that fact, I think.
Martina Navratilova will apparently end her tennis career without an Olympic medal. She and doubles partner Lisa Raymond lost to a Japanese team in Thursday's quarterfinals. Do you agree with me that the erstwhile Martina should pair up with Chris Evert in the 2008 Olympics for another go-around?
I don't know. I mean, I think she did this for a lark. You know, it's always fun until somebody gets out on the court and gets hurt. But she got out of this what she got out of it, which was the Olympic experience. And I don't think that anybody is going to think any less of her. I don't think her obit will be any shorter in the New York Times when she passes away that she didn't win an Olympic medal.
On Monday, two Norwegian beach volleyballers were reprimanded for the prominent display of birth control patches during their competition. If the women had cut those patches into Nike swooshes, would that have been okay?
Apparently, Gerhard Heiberg, a board member of the IOC, and who, like most board members of the IOC, ought to have better things to do. This is an advertising. Now, if you look at the picture, It's a white patch. Are you just supposed to assume, because these are Scandinavian women, that it's a birth control patch and not like a nicotine patch or a bandage? I can't tell.
Mr. Heiberg said quite clearly, it is illegal to advertise for products during the Olympics.
What product are you advertising? It's a white patch.
There was a great deal of guffawing when he said that, I think. Dwayne Chambers, the British sprinter who would have been at the Games in Athens if he hadn't been suspended for steroid use, has decided to try football American style at Chabot Junior College in California. You think Chabot might keep roster spots open for banned American sprinters as well?
Well, I don't know, but I like the reaction of the quarterback who said any quarterback who hears there's a dude coming to his school as a receiver who's the fourth fastest person in the world, all you're thinking is, I can't wait. You know, he'll have the spotlight on him. If he ever gets to an American college to play for real, there's going to be an extraordinary amount of spotlight on him. And there will be you know, people lining up around the block with little Dixie cups for him.
Jeremy Bloom, the former University of Colorado football player who's also training with the U.S. ski team in preparation for the Olympics in 2006, learned this week that the NCAA will not let him return to Colorado to play football. Where exactly did Mr. Bloom run afoul of the NCAA's rules?
Well, it's hard to imagine that anyone could run afoul of the NCAA rules, as simple and uncomplicated as they are. Basically, to survive as a skier at the top level, you have to have commercial endorsements. The NCAA considers this a special, an extra benefit under their incredibly complex and completely illogical special benefits rule, even though what Jeremy Bloom has gotten out of his skiing, he's earned every dime of it. You know, the NCAA is now setting itself completely athwart a meritocracy in another sport. I think he may wind up having to give up football.
Deion Sanders is apparently serious about returning to the National Football League, Charlie. I have to wonder, though, whether it would be safer and more lucrative for Deion to return to the pro sports scene as, oh, I don't know, an NBA center.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's probably in fairly decent shape. He could play in situations as football coaches like. And you know, Baltimore's a defense-conscious team. If it would be a good fit for him if he could get there. I mean, it's not like he's tackled anybody in the last 20 years.
And finally, Charlie, at the recent 8th Annual Ferret Olympics, a 16-month-old ferret named Boots won the 18-foot-long dryer hose run. I wonder if that event constitutes cruelty to ferrets.
Well, I don't know. I did see, however, the NBC feature about how Boots has overcome the great obstacle of actually being a ferret to win his gold medal. And I am waiting as the Ferret Olympics go along because I am dying to see Ann Coulter take part in the decathlon.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and ferrets out the truth each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Ann Getman of Cambridge, Massachusetts, contacted us through the website, onlyagame.org, and subsequently wrote, I am wowed by the links, multi-layered information, ability to hear your program with your typically wonderful ambient sound, and make multiple links for photos, background, etc. Kudos. Bob Cohen and Peter Tenney, the latter a Vermont Public Radio listener, wrote to say we should have credited Henry Mancini as the composer of the song Baby Elephant Walk, performed by René Touzé. We used Baby Elephant Walk in connection with our story on elephant polo a couple of weeks ago. Ted Hupert, who listens to the program on WFYI in Indianapolis, enjoyed last week's conversation with Catherine Jay, the author of More Than Just a Game. It caused him to remember heavyweight gold medal winner George Foreman walking around the ring with a little American flag at the 1968 Games. Quote, there have been few occasions when I have been as proud to be an American, he wrote. I can't even pass by a display of Mr. Foreman's grilling machines without remembering it. During last week's program, Charlie Pierce and I wondered whether the Adam Dunn home run that left Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati and landed in the Ohio River was an interstate dinger. Bob Manning, who hears Only a Game on WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, wrote to inform us that Kentucky owns the Ohio up to the historical low water mark on the north side, so Dunn's homer wouldn't even have had to reach the middle of the river to have crossed into Kentucky. Richard Stiller of Louisville, Gerald Foley of Columbus, Ohio, Mark Hoyer of St. Paul, Minnesota, and Stuart Dean, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, were among the many others who wrote to tell me essentially the same thing. And Mike of Big Pine Key, Florida, gratuitously added that I should repeat third-grade geography. I think I'll begin my re-education by getting rid of the Only a Game Atlas. Should you wish to comment on the quality of the curriculum at the Northeast School in Montclair, New Jersey, from 1953 until 1960, write me at Only a Game, WVUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can also reach the program through the aforementioned website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, and you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Though American swimmer Michael Phelps will not race in the men's 400-meter medley relay this afternoon in Athens, he may still earn his sixth gold medal because he did help his team reach the medal round. Phelps already has 5 gold medals and 2 bronze and has tied Mark Spitz's 32-year-old record of 4 individual swimming medals in 1 Olympiad. But one of the most highly publicized pre-Olympic stories concerned the likelihood that Phelps would tie or even break the record set by Spitz at the 1972 Games when he won 7 gold medals. Mark Spitz joins me now on the line from Athens. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
My pleasure.
Did you have mixed feelings as you realized that Michael Phelps was not going to exceed or tie your gold medal record?
I don't know if it's the right way to express it, mixed feelings. I had actually positive feelings, and they weren't mixed, that I thought he was really going to do this. I thought he had a chance, and that he's been the first person in 32 years really to come along to really challenge that 7 gold medal sort of feat. And, I mean, I was embracing this whole idea of doing it, because if, in fact, my record stands as a benchmark of which he measures himself by, then that's the greatest accolade that I can leave on my sport. And I take my hat off to him to want to do that. And he definitely had the capacity to do it.
So no feeling of, okay, I'm okay for at least another 4 years here.
No, not at all. I mean, the headlines in the Herald Tribune here in Athens said that it was Thorpe first, Phelps third, Spitz safe. I had a bunch of people call me asking, are you okay?
A couple of things that have been obvious to people watching the games on TV. One is that there have been an awful lot of empty seats at various events. And, of course, the other was there was tremendous concern about security before the games. How has your experience been watching the games? How have you felt about how things have gone?
Well, I'm here in Athens, and I can see it firsthand. In some of the more popular sports, the seats are totally filled. Keep in mind that the city of Sydney, Australia, sold an additional 1 million seats in ticketing after the opening ceremonies, and I would expect no different here. And so I think the total tally has yet to be had and to be acknowledged. And I think that most of the big money that's made in the Olympic Games is from licensing, television rights, and they've been very successful at doing so. And the security here is very apparent, as was the security in all of the other Olympic Games that I've actually been a part of, no different than Sydney, Australia 4 years ago.
What else have you been doing?
Well, I'm a stockbroker, and I'm a financial advisor in California. I do that on a regular basis, and I'm still able to do work no matter where I am in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, during the Olympic years and throughout since 1972, for 32 years, I have represented corporations involved with their Olympic involvement or my involvement because they associate me with, you know, the Olympics and winning 7 gold medals. So that's been relatively successful for me. And I can't believe that I still am able to do that after 32 years. I guess Michael Phelps has helped me live another 4 years, perhaps. But, you know, again, he has a tremendous ability to draw attention to the sport of swimming, which I'm obviously so fond of, but basically to the whole Olympic movement, which I think is in a real positive way.
I remember reading that you attempted to qualify for a second trip to the Olympics in 1992. What encouraged you to believe that you could compete at the highest level 20 years after your performance at Munich?
I was about 39 years old at the time. It was 1989, and somebody brought to my attention that through master swimming programs, which were people that were about my age at that time, competitively swimming, were doing times that were faster than they had done when they were 20.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of the times that I had done in 1972 had long been surpassed my world records. But one of those times, if I could actually just do the same time, the 100-meter butterfly, I would actually be competitive. As a matter of fact, I would actually be the most competitive in the whole world, because the two times that were actually set faster than mine, those gentlemen had retired. So I decided to make a comeback, challenging the fact that I could do that. Well, guess what? I was able to match my time, but I never accounted for the fact that one of them was going to come out of retirement because I encouraged him to do it, because I was making a comeback, because he never had a chance to swim against me, and he wanted to beat Mark Spitz. Well, guess what? He went on to not only beat Mark Spitz, he went on to Barcelona to win the gold medal. It was a great experience. I brought a lot of attention to my sport, and I showed, I think, a lot of humility to my son, who I showed him, because he obviously wasn't around in my youth, that if you want to get someplace, you need to be dedicated. And I was for 3 years doing that, and it was a great experience.
Your record, 7 gold medals, has already stood for 32 years. Does the likelihood of one swimmer achieving that sort of success become more remote as time goes by?
That's a difficult question to answer, only because I'm not a fortune teller. But if you wait long enough, the right combination of something will happen where somebody will be able to have the talent to do that. We're looking at that person right now. I mean, he's at the crossroads of just beginning his career. He has nothing but positive things to look forward towards the future. He's 19. If you analyze swimmers today, most men, when they get into their prime, are around 22 or 23. He's not that old yet. He'll be in that age category at the Olympic Games 4 years from now in Beijing, China. But sprinters, of which he'll have to actually learn a little bit more how to sprint and do the shorter distance freestyle events, those guys come into their prime when they're 28. So I see him going to the year 2012, and at that he'll only be 27 years old.
The swimmers competing at these games were born in the early 80s, some of them even more recently. How do they regard you? Is it like when Willie Mays walks into a Major League locker room?
I'm not quite sure how Willie Mays is regarded when he walks into the Major League locker room, but I know one thing. They all come up to me and say, Mr. Spitz, and I say, please just call me Mark.
Mark Spitz, the winner of 7 gold medals at the 72 Olympics, joining me from Athens. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Special thanks to Joanna Kakissis and to Nancy Greenlease. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Olympic champion swimmer Mark Spitz, who's currently in Athens pitching a men's hair care product, which, for obvious reasons, I had just assumed was Grecian formula.
I'm not familiar with that one, because that's not what I use.
That's what those Norwegian beach volleyball players said about the pill. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.